Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Friday, May 30th. I'm Jordan Pangelinan, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, the Eel River Wailaki Second Annual Big Time is happening tomorrow, May 31st. Who bombed Judy Berry? The question that still echoes 3 decades later. And civil rights complaint alleges anti-Semitism at Cal Poly Humboldt amid debate over campus climate. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. The Eel River Wailaki Second Annual Big Time is happening tomorrow, May 31st, starting at 10 a.m. with an opening prayer. Natasha Carrico, one of the leading organizers for the Big Time event, gives a brief overview of what to expect at the event tomorrow.
Every Big Time you go to is going to be a little different. And it's kind of particular to what that tribe, you know, what they want to do with it. And so what ours is about is we have provided a really good variety of vendors for, of course, everybody likes vendors, right? You can see a lot of really neat stuff, local artisans, jewelry that is made by natives.
Here is what to expect from the different vendors.
So our Big Time is going to have vendors, and we will be serving Indian tacos and hot dogs and assorted drinks. We also have an information booth that we encourage everybody to go up on the main stage at the community park and check out. All of our history will be up there. A lot of our committees are putting bios or pictures and stuff for everybody to look at. Our committees on our nonprofit is open for anybody in the community that feels like that's something they can really help with. You can join it and be a part of it and help a really cool kind of a movement that's happening with Native culture right now, especially in Southern Humboldt, as well as we're going to have some really cool merchandise for sale and a raffle. That's where if you want to purchase raffle tickets, you'll want to go up on the stage. And we have a lot of businesses around the area that have donated an item to us, as well as each vendor will be donating an item to raffle off. We'll also have drumming circles and singing and several dance groups.
Carrico says having an event like Big Time is important to the Indigenous people and preserving their culture. This is how the Wailaki people are doing it.
If we don't practice it, we lose it, right? Just as with anything we do in life. And if we don't put our dances out there, even at a community spectrum, we're going to lose it. And our children and great-grandchildren will never know what we did or how we did it. And, you know, it takes a village to bring back our old ways of things. And sometimes our old ways have to have a little bit of a new twist to it because, unfortunately, especially for the Wailakis, we have lost a lot of our information. And so what we do have, you know, we're really proud of, and we love to show the community and people what we do know and how we do it. And it's just really fun to watch. And it's so fun to see the little kids getting involved, and they're out there in their regalia, and they're trying their best. And I think they steal the show every time.
The Wailakis appreciate the community coming out to learn about their history and culture. It's a free admission and will be held at the Southern Humboldt Community Park. The address, 1144 Sproul Creek Road, Garberville, California. For more information, find them on Facebook at Friends of the Eel River, Wailaki, or email events@eelriverwailaki.com. Who bombed Judy Berry? It's a question that still lingers, 35 years after the infamous car bombing that shook the environmental movement. This week marks 3.5 decades since that pivotal day. Lauren Schmidt reports.
Car bomb explosion sends two members of the Earth First group to the hospital. And the question tonight is, will the injured environmentalist face criminal charges?
Good evening, everyone. This pipe bomb went off at a busy Oakland intersection, and the man and woman who were heard had planned to lead a summer of militant protest against logging practices in Northern California.
The two environmentalists injured when a bomb went off in their car just before noon are suspects and not just victims. The unconfirmed report says Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney will be charged with possession and transportation of explosives.
Those were the headlines on major television networks in the Bay Area 35 years ago. Following the car bombing of Redwood Summer leader and Earth First organizer Judy Berry and her colleague Daryl Cherney. The two were driving through Oakland, California, when a pipe bomb exploded beneath Berry's seat. She was severely injured. Cherney, riding in the passenger seat, sustained minor injuries. But instead of being treated as victims, both Berry and Cherney were arrested and charged with transporting explosives. The charges were eventually dropped, and the two would later file a landmark civil rights lawsuit against the FBI and Oakland Police Department, alleging they were framed to discredit the nonviolent environmental movement. Berry often said, quote, "The FBI should find who bombed me and fire them," close quote. The following is a clip from the documentary Who Bombed Judy Berry, where you can hear directly from Judy about what happened.
On May 24th of 1990, I was bombed and nearly killed in a car bomb assassination attempt. I was driving my car, and I was driving down the street, and I was following somebody. At a certain point, I think she was getting ready to make a turn, and I was trying to follow her and realized I wasn't going right, and I quickly hit the brake. And at the time when I hit the brake, there was a very huge explosion, and I felt it rip through me, the explosion being so powerful that the sound itself had a force. The next thing I remember, the car was stopped, and there were people around, and I was in incredible pain that I had never felt before. I knew my back was broken. My legs both were immobile at the time. I knew that my body was ruined. I knew that I was paralyzed. I felt that I was dying.
I heard a crack, and then my whole head started to ring. Then I heard somebody scream out, "It's a bomb. There was a bomb." And then it all made sense that someone had tried to kill us.
That last voice was Daryl Cherney calling into KMUD from jail shortly after the 1990 car bombing. At the time, the FBI and Oakland police accused Berry and Cherney of transporting the pipe bomb themselves, claiming they intended to commit so-called environmental terrorism, despite the fact that their actions were rooted in nonviolence. Law enforcement never investigated other suspects, even though Berry and Cherney had received numerous death threats due to their leadership in a growing national effort to stop the clear-cutting of California's remaining old-growth redwood forests. Despite a coordinated smear campaign, Berry and Cherney never wavered in maintaining their innocence or in their commitment to nonviolent resistance.
We've charged them with false arrest, illegal search and seizure, unequal protection of the law, and conspiracy to violate our First Amendment rights by discrediting us as terrorists.
Although Judy Berry survived the bombing, the injuries left her in chronic pain and ultimately devastated her health. She passed away in 1997. Her best friend, co-organizer, and bandmate, Daryl Cherney, carried on the fight, taking the FBI and Oakland police to court in a landmark civil rights lawsuit that would ultimately vindicate the Earth First organizers.
The jury today found that 6 of 7 law enforcers themselves broke the law, violated civil rights, in essence, framing Cherney and Berry.
Now, 12 years later, a jury has awarded Cherney and the late Judy Berry $4.4 million for illegal search and false arrest.
I feel a great relief. I feel a great sadness that Judy is not here to experience this victory. But then I also know that Judy Berry is here in a way. Her spirit has been in this courtroom for this entire time.
While Berry and Cherney were ultimately cleared of all charges, no other suspects were ever investigated. In a 2012 interview with Democracy Now, following the release of the documentary Who Bombed Judy Berry, Daryl Cherney shared his perspective on why that may be.
I believe that it was the timber industry in conjunction with the FBI, because a lot of us have experienced that law enforcement defends the status quo, defends the 1%, that it was a combination of those two who conspired to bomb Judy Berry. And we believe it was done at bomb school 30 days earlier, when the head of Louisiana Pacific Security was hosting the FBI in a bomb tech course in which they were blowing up cars with pipe bombs just 30 days before we were bombed in a car in Oakland.
That was May 24th, the day that is now Judy Berry Day in Oakland, May 24th, 1990, the day that you and Judy Berry were bombed. What does the FBI say today, Daryl?
Well, we're trying to get some evidence back from them to have it tested for DNA and fingerprints. And the FBI is basically saying that they don't want to turn any evidence over to me and my attorneys.
But that has since changed.
So, you know, without getting too far ahead of the story, you know, 10 years later, we tested the DNA.
I spoke with Daryl Cherney in the K-Mud studio this afternoon to commemorate the 35th anniversary. K-Mud News will bring you the full story next week, which includes updates in the case. But for now, Daryl says he remains as determined as ever to solve the cold case, especially with recent advances in DNA testing that could finally lead to answers.
It's something that I'm always going to work on, finding out who bombed Judy Berry. I called it Judy's last instructions. She said, you need to carry on this lawsuit. You're the only one who knows what happened. You're the only one who can really do this.
Reporting for KMUD, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
In March, the Louis D. Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law, along with the Jewish on Campus, filed a complaint with Cal Poly Humboldt regarding alleged violations of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Alleged violations allowed for verbal and physical harassment, exclusion, and abuse of Jewish students. According to the original complaint, Jewish students were repeatedly attacked, forced out of areas of campus, and subjected to ongoing anti-Semitism on campus grounds. Robin Pick, the senior counsel and attorney at the Louis D. Brandeis Center, had this to say about the complaint and its purpose.
The climate on campus was hostile for Jewish students, and the administration didn't take any action. There were violations of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And as a result, we filed a complaint with the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights.
Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits discrimination based on race, color, or national origin in programs and activities receiving federal financial assistance. Pick explains that Jewish students are protected by this, and the university is required to take action to prevent any harassment from occurring.
Jews are protected by Title VI based on shared ancestry and ethnicity. And when there is a hostile environment based on any of these protected categories, a university is required to take prompt and effective action to eliminate the harassment, to address the hostile climate and prevent it from recurring. So here on this campus, we had both a severe and pervasive climate of hostility against Jewish students, and I can get into some examples of what students were facing on campus. The administrators were put on notice. The students were reporting incidents countless times, repeatedly, emails, in-person meetings, and there were many instances in which administrators were witnessing incidents against Jewish students in person, and still they failed to take any action. That's a violation of Title VI, and that's what led to us filing this complaint so that the Office for Civil Rights can open an investigation, which they just did, and ultimately hold this school accountable.
Pick gives us a few examples of the climate some Jewish students might have faced on Cal Poly Humboldt's campus.
There was, in the fall, there was a club fair where students were tabling. Various clubs were given the opportunity to show what they do. And there was a Jewish student club. They were being harassed by other students, screaming at them, calling them names, calling them baby killers and genocide supporters, grabbing items off the table, physically blocking students from approaching the Jewish group. There were administrators who were present at that event, and when students from the Jewish group reported this to the administrators standing nearby, they didn't take any action, but instead they instructed the Jewish students to leave early to avoid any more problems. So that's problematic on multiple levels. One, the Jewish students were harassed. They weren't protected. But not only that, they were then pushed out and excluded instead of having the administrators actually address the problem.
K-Mud reached out to Cal Poly Humboldt, specifically President Spagna, and was given an email response on behalf. Addressing the complaint, here is Eileen Yu, the Director of News and Information, had to write, in quote, "We do not have additional information to share. We do want to reiterate, however, the president's message that we have a zero tolerance for anti-Semitism, discrimination, harassment, or any actions and speech that infringe on the rights, dignities, or safety of others. We are working closely with the California State University to respond of the Office of Civil Rights Investigation and ensure we are compliant with all federal requirements," end quote. Hick believes there are different ways to hold Cal Poly Humboldt accountable for discrimination that is allegedly being targeted towards Jewish students, whether it's students or faculty.
The conditions for Jewish students at Cal Poly Humboldt have been horrific, and it's not been a safe campus. And we believe that having OCR open this investigation creates the opportunity to hold this university accountable. And we hope that as a result of the investigation, that Cal Poly will be required either voluntarily or through OCR's resolution process to make changes on their campus to protect Jewish students. And, you know, I can give you some examples of some of the actions that they can take to create a climate that is safe for all students, including Jewish students.
Pick suggests even adopting a new definition of anti-Semitism that other universities under investigation have already adopted or in the process of adopting.
One would be to incorporate the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism, including its guiding examples, into Cal Poly Humboldt's policies. That's otherwise known as the IRA definition of anti-Semitism. And the reason why this is important is because there are occasions where the university may not recognize anti-Semitism when it happens. And if they can't recognize it, they can't take action to stop it. And the IRA definition is the gold standard. It's internationally recognized all over the world. It's been it's recognized by the United States government. It's used by OCR. And it makes clear when conduct is anti-Semitic. And so once they have these guidelines to illuminate when conduct is anti-Semitic, then they can take action. So that's one really important piece. We also think it's important for them to provide mandatory training on anti-Semitism to all administrators, faculty, students, and staff members who interact with students. The training should familiarize all members of the community with traditional as well as contemporary forms of anti-Semitic stereotypes and conspiracy theories, so that Cal Poly Humboldt community will be able to identify and respond to anti-Semitic incidents in the future as they arise, particularly that those that involve Jewish ethnicity and shared ancestry connected to Israel, because that part of Jewish identity has been under attack on this campus.
However, Rabbi and lecturer at Cal Poly Humboldt, Naomi Steinberg believed that the protests that happened last May were not anti-Semitic, and in a letter sent on behalf of Temple Beth El to Senator Mike McGuire and Assemblymember Jim Wood, that, in quote, "crimes and discrimination must be taken seriously and spurious charges of anti-Semitism must be scrupulously avoided. We appreciate your service to the community and want to make sure you understand the risks of potential harm and escalation that come from a politicized use of the term anti-Semitism," end quote. The letter states that within the past decades, very few anti-Semitic incidents on campus came to their attention, as well as little anti-Semitic activity in the community at large. Rabbi Steinberg explains things have changed in recent years, even before the October 7th attack.
We've spoken a couple times about a big rise in anti-Semitic activity up here. For decades, there was very little, and I felt really blessed, and I love being a rabbi.
The following fall, there was an anti-Semitic crime following a desecration of a harvest sukkah.
And then in November, a very troubling petition went out on the all-campus email urging people to rally to the Palestinian cause. And while you know I've spoken very sympathetically to the Palestinian cause for decades and have visited Israel, visited Palestine, worked with rabbis for human rights, done everything I can, the petition was so inappropriate and so poorly worded and so badly timed. Everything about it was wrong. And it turns out that it was did not have official sanction. And we have not had any answers to who put that petition on, if the university email was hacked or someone gave permission. It was very troubling. We were very busy over the winter. And in early February, we wrote a letter to administration saying, we're concerned about the bad climate on campus for Jewish faculty, staff, and students. And we want to know, how did that petition get distributed to all, 7,000 people on the list, something like that? Many of whom were very upset. Jewish students especially, so they were shocked to get that on their campus email.
She continues to explain that during an actual instance of an anti-Semitic crime, the university stayed silent.
We made a request to discuss it, and we also have some creative ideas to share. We said to administration, we can come in, talk to you about some things, and we think we can make some improvements. Long story short, they simply ignored us. Very painful, very disturbing.
In that same letter, Senator Mike McGuire and Assemblymember Jim Wood, echoing the university statement citing anti-Semitic hate speech as a cause for conducting the large law enforcement operation that took place last April.
So I was quite disturbed when I saw that press release from our wonderful elected representatives, and I feel that they have been misled by the university. In fact, the university ignored serious problems with anti-Semitism for months and then turned around and made spurious claims of anti-Semitism against the protesters.
Rabbi Steinberg further explains that the protest demonstrated a lack of cultural sensitivity and indifference to alienation of Jewish students with opposing views, and that the university ignored offers to help from Jewish leaders and failed to provide students, faculty, and staff to address anti-Semitism and support Jewish life on campus. However, this wasn't always the case. Many Jewish and non-Jewish students came together to protest the war that has killed thousands.
I think that it was very well received by the students who were there, who realized, oh, we're not being shunned by the Jewish community because we are outspoken and we're expressing our sorrow and our rage over what's happening in Gaza.
Rabbi Steinberg hoped with the letter was to let the community understand the risks of potential harm and escalation that come from a politicized use of the term anti-Semitism.
We want the public to know that we take anti-Semitism very, very seriously. It is a real danger. It's really going on. In the last 2 years, we've had horrible anti-Semitic flyers distributed all over the county, including at Jewish homes, here at Temple Beth El, at Chabad in Arcata, Very, very disturbing. It's real. So we want people to take it seriously. At the same time, we absolutely protest having it, as you said, weaponized, used as a weapon against the protesters. So when I hear people like Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House, who represents a very extreme fundamentalist Christian point of view with extreme views about Jews, when I hear him claiming to suddenly be our defender, I know that all he's trying to do is to discredit our universities. They're trying to smear not just the protesters, but our universities themselves. Am I happy with the analysis of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict that's going on in many campuses? No. It's not merely settler colonialism. It's also religious fanaticism. And I'm sorry to say, it's religious fanatics in Islam and also in Judaism. And they play a huge role in this conflict. So that has to be addressed. But I'm very upset. Our universities are the last bastions of free thought. That and the radio and the press. A free press and a free university is essential to our country.
Ray Hamill brings us details of all of this week's big local sports stories, including all of the latest from the North Coast section, baseball and softball playoffs, why it was a very successful spring for McKinley High sports, which athlete will represent the HDNL at this weekend's state track and field championships, and why this weekend really does mark the beginning of the summer sports season in this report.
It's championship weekend in North Coast Section baseball and softball, and two local teams will be involved. Hello and welcome to this week's Kaymud News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on all of this week's NCS playoff action in just a moment, as we take a look at all of the big local sports stories of the week, including news of a local athlete who was crowned a state champion, who will be representing the HDNL at this weekend's track and field state championships, which athletes have been included on the inaugural HDN All Sportsmanship team, why it was a very successful spring for the McKinleyville Panthers, and why this weekend really does mark the beginning of the summer sports season. But first up, two local teams will play for a North Coast Section Championship this weekend. In baseball, the Arcata Tigers will play Kennedy High School in the Division 5 decider, while in softball, Willits will face off against St. Vincent de Paul in the Division 6 championship game. The Tigers took care of business in their semifinal against St. Bernard's, winning 5-2 at Arcata High School on Tuesday evening. The number 2 seeded Tigers will host the championship game on Friday night as they look to secure a fourth section crown in the past 8 NCS postseasons. Under the guidance of longtime head coach Troy Gazzetti, the Arcata boys previously won NCS titles in 2016, 2019, and 2023. There were no playoffs held in 2020 or 2021 because of the pandemic. The Willits girls also will play for a section championship in softball after beating top seed Kelseyville 7-5 in their semi-final on Tuesday. The Wolverines will be playing for some history, having never won a section title in the sport before. In other NCS games this week, the McKinleyville Panthers lost a well-played and competitive semi-final in the Division 5 softball tournament, falling 2-1 to Miramonte on Wednesday. It was the Matadors' second win over an HDNL team in 4 days. They also ended the South Fork Cubs season with a 7-2 win in Saturday's quarterfinal. However, it was a memorable season for the Cubs despite the loss, as they clinched a first Little Four championship in 35 years, and with most of the players on a very young roster due back next spring, they should only get better. Also in softball action last Friday, Big 5 champion Del Norte lost 7-4 to Freedom in Division 3, Ferndale fell 7-2 at Kelseyville in Division 6, and the McKinleyville Panthers won their quarterfinal against Clear Lake 10-0. The following day, Hoopa lost 3-2 at St. Vincent de Paul in the Division 6 bracket. In local college baseball news, former Eureka Lager Jackson Jaconi won a California JUCO state championship with Mount San Antonio College on Monday. The Mounties capped three dominating days in the state tournament with an 8-5 win over West Valley in 13 innings in the final. Jaconi, who scored the winning run, finished 3-5 in the championship game. In local high school track and field, Arcata junior Skylar Collenberg qualified for this weekend's state championships in Clovis after placing third at last weekend's NCS Meet of Champions in the boys' shot put. The Tigers' standout broke his own school record by more than 2.5 feet with a throw of 55 feet 6.25 inches. Several other local athletes also made the trip to the Bay Area for the prestigious Meet of Champions, including Del Norte Jr. and HDNL record holder in the boys' 100 meters, Deacon Hanks. Hanks, who had beaten his own league record on each of the previous two weekends, placed 8th at the Meet of Champions, crossing the finish line in a time of 11.02 seconds. Hanks' league record time is 10.57 seconds. In other local sports news this week, the HDNL released its inaugural all-sportsmanship team, which is the brainchild of the league's Student Athlete Advisory Council and is made up of one student athlete from each of the 10 participating schools. According to the council's guidelines, the emphasis for the all-sportsmanship team is on recognizing individuals who embody the spirit of good sportsmanship and demonstrate leadership qualities rather than solely focusing on athletic ability. The honorees were selected by the individual schools. The all-sportsmanship team included Arcata's Lillian Cunningham, Del Norte's Tacinte Steinruck, Eureka's Ryder Mitchell, Ferndale's Eaton Weitzel, Fortuna's Myra Hayes, Hoopa's Lyle McKinnon, McKinleyville's Joseph Forbes Capiello, North Coast Prep's Joey Hodge, South Fork's Wesley Way, and St. Bernard's Natalie McLaughlin. Elsewhere in local sports this week, Arcata senior Malia Jackson announced she will continue her playing career in two sports at College of the Redwoods. Jackson will compete in basketball and track and field for the local community college after a very successful high school career. The starting guard was an all-league selection in basketball and played a big role in helping to lead the Tigers to a Big Five championship this past winter. She also was a part of the Arcata team that made it all the way to the NorCal Division IV championship game in her junior year. She is also a two-time league champion in the girls' pole vault in track and field. Several McKinleyville Panthers also have announced recently that they will continue their playing careers in college, including senior Nick Marr, who this week committed to play basketball for Hartnell College. Other McKinleyville student athletes who recently committed to college teams include Riley Colart, who will play soccer at Lake Tahoe Community College, Joe Gatlin, who will play football at Mount Mercy University in Iowa, Jackson Kelly, who will play baseball at Shoreline Community College in Washington, Stephen Graves and Jackson Nigerian, who will both play football at College of the Redwoods, Tatum Fisher, who will play basketball at George Fox University, Jake Gardner, who will compete in golf at Simpson University, and Gabby Watson, who will play basketball at Clark University in Massachusetts. And closing out this week, it's a sure sign the summer sports season is upon us when the Humboldt Crabs take the field. The local club will kick off the 2025 season when they open a three-game weekend series against the Novato Knicks at the Arcata Ballpark on Friday night. They also have games scheduled against the Knicks on Saturday night and Sunday afternoon before hosting the Humboldt Eagles on Wednesday night. And that's this week's KMUD News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineers, Michael McCaskill and Dennis Marr. And thanks to our reporter, Lauren Schmidt. KMUD News is online and you can find us on KMUD.org. And now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscast for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605. Again, that is 707-923-2605, or send an email to news@kmud.org. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Jordan Pangelinan.